I'm going to start off this evening talking about Mars and Venus and what they tell us about creation. You know, as creationists, we're always looking for design and purpose in the world around us. I think in the biological realm, it's pretty obvious when you see design. I'm a little concerned about design sometimes in astronomy. I think sometimes my creation brethren see design where I don't necessarily see any. And I'm challenged then, personally, I think, to try to find design. And I'm cogitating this quite a bit. And tonight I want to share with you what I think, perhaps, are two design elements dealing with Mars and Venus, the closest planets to us, typically. I want to start off showing a picture of Mars. This is one of the best pictures of Mars taken from near the Earth. This is the Hubble Space Telescope, HST, photo taken several years ago. And it shows very nicely the polar ice caps on the top and bottom of the planet. You can see a little few clouds up actually around one of the two caps. And you also have some dark and light markings on the surface of the planet. From the Earth, you can't see the Mars that well through a telescope. I've looked at it through some pretty good-sized telescopes over the years, and it's really kind of cool when you can see some dark and light markings on the planet. So if you looked at that one, had poor eyesight, or kind of squinted, it might give you an idea what you might see through a big telescope. Mars can be very disappointing. It really is not real close to us except about every other year. About every 26 months it comes close. And even then, those opportunities aren't as good as they are other times. Back in 2003, Mars was closest it had been to the Earth in history. So it was an amazing time. It'll be nice again in about 2020. And Mars will be in opposition next year sometime, but it won't be particularly good because it's kind of far away yet when it reaches that point. But you can see a lot of nice details on Mars. Mars, I think, is one of the most interesting planets out there as far as the surface features are concerned. I'll talk more about that in just a minute. But here's a close-up made with a spacecraft. We send a number of space probes to Mars to do reconnaissance of the surface. That big gash you see across the bottom there, that is a large chasm called Valles Marineris. It's about as wide as the United States is, which means it's not quite as wide as Canada is from end to end. And it's pretty deep, and it's pretty wide. It's actually deeper and wider than Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon's pretty impressive, but it would just be a little tiny side tributary to this. One difference with Grand Canyon, however, is it's not water-carved. It is believed to be a large tectonic rift on the surface. On the left there, you can see three dark dots. Those are large volcanoes. There are two volcanic regions on Mars. One of the volcanoes is like 70,000 feet tall. It's the biggest volcano that we know of. Nothing on the Earth quite compares to it in size. It's an amazing world. And I want to talk about the gross properties of Mars. It's about 53% the size of Mars, so a little over half, excuse me, as the Earth, a little over half the size of the Earth. And it only has 11% the mass of the Earth. So it's quite a bit less mass than we have. The density is a bit less, too. And if you're on the surface of Mars, you would only have 39% of the gravity that you have here on the Earth. And I could probably dunk a basketball on Mars. However, if you wanted to make it fair, you'd probably raise the rim a bit on Mars. So you would see guys who could jam, you know, a ball, you know, 15, 16 feet up in the rim. So that would be pretty impressive, I think. I think a basketball game on Mars would be really impressive all the way around. It's 52% farther from the sun on average, so it gets quite a bit less energy from the sun than what the Earth receives. So it's quite a bit cooler than the Earth. That's really kind of an understatement. And then it has a 25-degree tilt, 24-degree tilt. Now, the Earth, you know, is 23.5. So the tilt of its axis is very similar to that of the Earth, and hence it has seasons. Those ice caps I described to you earlier, they grow and shrink during the winter months in one hemisphere. That the ice caps gets much larger, and then during the summer, it shrinks back in size. One of them just about totally disappearing at that point. And its rotation period is only 37 minutes longer than that of the Earth. So if you were to move to Mars, and that's not such a far-fetched idea if we ever wanted to send a manned probe to Mars, the people involved would have to spend about a year either on Mars or orbiting around Mars. So if you had a Mars base for that year, I think most of us could probably adjust to the 37, 40 minutes longer in the day. It's not that far removed from what our rotation period is. So in many respects, you would find that Mars would be similar to Earth, except it would be a lot colder, all right? A lot colder than it is here. And so we have many similarities to Earth, and that kind of captivated people. When people began to understand that, particularly in the 19th century, this caused quite a bit of excitement. There's a man named Percival Lowell. You may have heard of him. He was a wealthy Bostonian, an attorney, and he did his business interest by day, I guess, but his real passion was astronomy. He became very interested in astronomy. By the way, he was one of the first Westerners to go to Japan after it opened and spend a considerable amount of time there. He spent several years in Japan traveling and learning the culture. He became an expert on Japan and its culture, and did a lot of lectures and wrote some books and things about Japan. He then became interested in astronomy. He eventually went out to Flagstaff, Arizona, and established in 1894, I believe, Lowell Observatory, which is the oldest privately funded research observatory in the world, and it still exists today and does good work. Well, he became fascinated with Mars. That's what really dragged him into doing astronomy. He went to Flagstaff to get better skies. When Mars came available for observing every other year, he wanted the best location to do this, and he thought Flagstaff was it. And it is really an excellent location for doing this kind of work. There had been a fellow named Schiaparelli in Italy in the 1880s, I believe, who saw these little lines on Mars, and he called them channels. And the Italian word for channel is canali, which unfortunately was translated as canals into English. Schiaparelli really wasn't. Well, if I say the word canal, it suggests, doesn't it, a man-made structure, usually for ships to travel through, or just to transport water many times. So they do in desert areas. I know I've driven across Arizona many times and across parts of Southern California, and you'll cross this canal in many different places where they transport water for irrigation and for drinking. So that kind of grabs your fascination when you see a planet that has canals sitting on it. And also you see polar ice caps. I've already mentioned those. When you think polar ice caps, you're going to think, well, it must be made of water just like it is here on the Earth. So that makes sense. And there are no bodies of water on Mars. Even from the Earth with ground-based telescopes, you can see there are no large bodies of water. So it's kind of a desert planet. People understood that pretty early on. So imagine if the Earth had no oceans. Maybe there'd be smaller lakes or something. But if it were like that, our climate would be very different. And water would be a very precious commodity. It'd be like the entire planet would be like living in Phoenix or something, except not quite as warm. And so water would be necessary for people and for agriculture. All the way around, you're going to need the water to grow the food, so you're going to need it for people again. So that kind of tied together. And also Lowell saw color changes on Mars. He thought that there were in northern and southern hemispheres, when summer came, it looked more green. And then as autumn and winter approached, it looked more brown. And of course, that suggests photosynthesis going on. I think if you were to observe much of North America right now from space, you'd find that at northern latitudes, it's turning brown because leaves are losing their chlorophyll and going back to normal pigments. And of course, it would green back up in the spring. And that's what Lowell thought he saw here on Mars. So he worked together a nice conclusion. He presented this in a number of lectures. He traveled around, gave these lectures. He wrote articles. I think Atlantic Monthly carried a lot of these. Eventually, they were collected into a series of books. He wrote, I think, three or four books on Mars. One book was called Mars. Another one was called Mars and Its Canals. And another one was called Mars as the Abode of Life. And his thesis was that it was a desert planet that was in a superior race there, superior to man. And they were able to build large canals to transport water from the Arctic and Antarctic regions to the more tropical regions where most of the population lived. And he mapped out these canals. He saw what he thought were oases where some canals intersected. It was a really nice thesis that seemed to be backed up with a lot of data. It certainly caught the fancy of the public. However, a lot of astronomers saw things very differently. There was a guy named Barnard who was a contemporary, and he was one of the keenest observers at the time, and he never did see canals. So while the popular accounts gained the day, most people weren't paying a whole lot of attention to what other astronomers said. You know, Mars has life. That's a news story. But no, it doesn't. Isn't. I mean, which one of those is going to get played on the television today? If a scientist says, I have proof that life exists on Mars, they're going to get airplay. And if I come up and I say, I have proof refuting his proof, no one's going to be in the time of day, are they? So it's one of those filtering situations. So if you look at the history of this, it looks like the entire scientific community endorsed it 100 years ago, and that wasn't the case at all. It's simply the public fancy caught on. Well, it had quite an impact on people. For instance, Edgar Rice Burroughs set 11 novels on the surface of Mars. He started writing these in 1912. Anybody know who Edgar Rice Burroughs was? What else he wrote?
Tarzan.
Very good. Who said Tarzan? You a real fan of Burroughs?
No.
I just happen to know that, huh? Okay, but he's better known for his Tarzan series, but he had 11 novels set there starting a century ago. And about that time, H.G. Wells wrote his book, War of the Worlds. It's been made into movies twice, I think. Also, we had the famous it was 1938 radio production that Orson Welles did that scared people. They thought that the world was really being invaded at the time. It seemed so real to people, even though they broke in a number of times and told you this was a Mercury production theater dramatization. They didn't catch that for some reason. Didn't understand what that meant. That's the 1938 broadcast that he had. Ray Bradbury, a bit later, I think in the 50s, wrote the Martian Chronicles. There's a real theme going on here, isn't there? Mars was a really hot place. I remember when I was a kid in the early 60s, mid-60s, sometimes on Saturday afternoons, you'd see these sci-fi movies. And it was almost always Martians coming here to take over, destroy, or whatever. I know in the War of the Worlds, if you've seen either or both of those movies, the Martians are winning, aren't they? Until they succumb to, if you read the book, same thing happens. They succumb to ordinary little diseases that we had. It's kind of like when settlers came to North America, they brought all these things like smallpox and whooping cough and things that really the Indians, or Native Americans, excuse me, maybe PC here, had no immunity to. And so it's kind of reversed here. They came here and our illnesses still did the invaders in for a change. Well, what was reality? Well, I remember as a kid, the reality came along in 1965. We spent the Mariner 4 probe past Mars. It was just a flyby mission. I remember reading about this. I was just finishing up fifth grade, and it was in my weekly reader. You all still have those things? I don't know. That was a thing everybody had in school, at least in the States back in the 60s. It came out every week, hence the name My Weekly Reader. It had little stories about what was going on in the news and so forth. And it had a feature article on the Mars and this flyby. And all it did is it flew past the planet, didn't go into orbit. We were kind of just starting to do this kind of thing back then. And it took some pictures of the surface, and it revealed a lot of craters. And that really surprised everybody. The people at NASA at the time said, whoa, it's a cratered world. We went to thinking that it was a place where life might exist to thinking it was like the moon. There's a real good lesson here. You see, the Mariner space probe, the Mariner 4, as it flew by the planet, only photographed 1% of the planet. So when you have 1% reconnaissance of something, you need to be very careful how you interpret that. I'll give you another example of that. You all know what trilobites are? What they were? These are creatures, or as far as we know, they're extinct, but they're found in a lot of fossils of the Cambrian particularly. And I remember when I was a kid going to this local science museum, and they had on display there, turned out it was a cast, but I didn't know that at the time, of a foot-long trilobite. And seeing that, I just kind of figured that was a typical trilobite. So a few years later, I'm going out, early 70s, I'm off in college, I'm taking a geology class, introduction to it. I kept seeing these little photographs of trilobites, and they're all like, you know, this big or something, you know. So finally, I raised my hand, and I asked the professor, I said, well, where are the big ones? You know, these all look so small. I said, well, they were that size. And I said, well, I've seen one that was a foot long. And it just bolted out of the seat and said, they didn't get that big. Well, as it turns out, a few of them did. Well, I went up that summer, and I went back to the museum, and I read the fine print that I didn't read when I was in sixth grade. Sixth graders can be tough, can't they? And turns out they had found this complete trilobite in 1919 locally when they're building a dam. And for many decades, it was the largest complete trilobite ever found. It's been eclipsed now in more recent years, but for a long time, it was the largest complete ever found. And so I saw a monster of a trilobite, and I assumed that was a normal trilobite. So you got to be very careful when you see a trilobite. Is it a typical one, or is it a rare one? And when you look at 1% of the surface of a planet, are you seeing the typical representation of the surface, or is it an odd one? Well, as it turns out, it was a bit different. There was another flyby in 1967, which got about 10% of the surface, and it had very few craters. So people said, well, what's going on with this? You know, one mission says lots of craters, the other one says few craters. Well, it's because Mars is more complicated than that. It's got some areas that are heavily cratered, areas that aren't so heavily cratered. And so we went back with additional probes. In 1969 and 71, we had orbiters that went around and took photographs of the entire surface, mapped it pretty well. And then we had other probes after that. In 76, the United States spent the first landers there and orbiters in 76. And then we spent 20 years plus with no missions to Mars. And then finally we went back in Pathfinder and Sojourner in 97. And since then we've had Opportunity and Spirit. We've just been doing all sorts of cool things with little rovers that run around across the surface and do things. So what is the reality of things? Well, first of all, we found over the years, in the last 50 years of studying Mars up close, that the atmospheric pressure is less than 1% of that at the Earth's surface. You'd have to go up 30 kilometers above the Earth's surface to reach the same level of atmospheric pressure. Obviously, if you're going to go to Mars, you're going to need a pressure suit. I remember when I was a kid seeing artist depictions of what a Martian explorer might look like, and what I saw was a guy wearing some headgear, and strapped on his back was an oxygen tank, and he had a plaid work shirt on, you know. Well, you're not going to survive in that. You're going to need a pressure suit like they wore in space or in the surface of the moon. And it's also very cold. The warmest day on Mars is still colder than the coldest day on Earth. That's what it's like. You know, the Russians for a very long time have run a station, Vladivostok station in Antarctica. It's up on a plateau. It's, I think, 10 or 12,000 feet up. It's probably the coldest place on Earth. The atmospheric pressure is low. It's very cold. And if you wanted to kind of get yourself acclimated, or you know, want to ask yourself the question, what would a mission to Mars be like? That's sort of getting there. You know, if you asked me, would you want to spend a year at Vladivostok Station? I think I would pass. But if you asked me if I wanted to spend a year on Mars, I think I might be inclined to go. I mean, it's just on a different world. It would be very nice thing to do, I would think, if my wife would let me do it. So, anyway, the surface temperature can briefly exceed freezing. What I'm talking about there is just the rocks themselves can sometimes get up above the freezing point of water. But the air never does. The air is always very cold there. So be careful when you try to interpret temperature. Surface temperatures and air temperatures can be very different things. And again, the air temperature is always far below freezing, so it's not a good situation. And very little water exists on Mars. I already alluded to that, the fact there are no big bodies of water. But we do know water does exist there, but none of it is liquid. Turns out it's all either in the ice form or it's in a vapor form, a gas form. The reason being is the conditions there are actually below the triple point of water, so you've got water can exist in gas or liquid, but not gas or solid, but not as liquid. If you had a container of water, opened up, poured it out on Mars, a portion of it would pretty quickly evaporate, and a portion of it would pretty quickly freeze, and it wouldn't take long at all. You'd have no liquid water left at all on the surface. However, one time water was very abundant on Mars. How do we know that? Well, we can see river channels on the surface which show extensive erosion sometime in the past. It's possible, I guess, that some other liquid could have carved those, but we have no idea what that liquid might have been. Some of these appear to be due to catastrophic floods. It looks the type of erosion features I see could only happen with large amounts of water over a very brief period of time. And we see some meandering and other drainage on nearly flat land, which is interesting. Also, there are some features on hillsides that look like shorelines, and this suggests bodies of water in the past. Some of these shorelines, if that's what they are, would indicate that water was many hundreds of meters deep over extensive portions of the Martian surface at one time. I remember back about, 12, 13, 15 years ago, we had one of the missions to the surface. We first started finding these things, and I cut out an editorial cartoon of this, and I took it with me. I was going to ICR, Institute for Creation Research in Southern California. I took it with me, and I showed it to John Morris, and president of ICR, and he liked it so much he asked if I could have it. I should have made a copy of it because it was a nice cartoon that showed the NASA people talking about the radioing from the surface. And here's this little spacecraft saying we found irrefutable evidence of a worldwide flood on Mars, and there's a little Martian rover taking a photograph of this big wooden ark sitting on the surface. So a sort of thing that comes to mind on this sort of thing. This is one of the drainage photos. You can see that some craters interspersed. Interpreting Mars is tricky. I have a good friend of mine who's attempted to do some interpretation of it in terms of a recent creation model, but even in a billions of years time frame, it's difficult to interpret, you know, with the past on Mars by looking at the surface, what kind of scenarios, because you need to explain the large amount of craters that are pretty pristine, but also the water on the surface. It suggests some really rapid catastrophic events going on. And if you fly over the desert regions like the American Southwest, it looks a lot like that in places, except you don't see so many craters sitting around. Here's another river, meandering river channel. This was taken back in I like this photo. It's taken from the Viking probe back in 76. Now this next one, I've always been a favorite of mine. When I saw this photo first time many years ago, I knew exactly what was going on here. You can see there's a couple of craters there. That doesn't show up really well on the screen, I'm afraid. The original looks much better. But you can see that there's kind of like a teardrop-shaped structure going from the lower right to the upper left. You see a couple of them sitting there. And when I saw that, I knew exactly what had made that, because as a kid, I had a paper route next to a large apartment complex, and they built some new apartments to add on to this thing, new buildings, and they had a lot of dirt sitting around these places. And I would go over there, and every day I'd go to my paper, and I'd go, look at the dirt, and you'd see where it carved little canyons and valleys in the dirt. I didn't know at the time, but I was doing just a little bit of scientific work. I was seeing a mock-up of, you know, much larger erosion features that could take place. And sometimes you would see a large place where it was maybe not real steep, and so water as it drained would go along a big flat sheet like this, and there would be an obstruction. It might be a brick or a piece of 2x4, but when the water moving across the dirt would hit that obstruction, the water would kind of rise up in front of it and then go around it. And as it went around it, it would lose speed behind it. And any sediment load that it had, it would drop right there. And at the time, I didn't understand the physics like I do today, but it always left teardrop-shaped islands. And so when I look at this photograph, I can tell which direction the flow was going, from lower right to upper left. So by looking at these kind of structures, you can really deduce a lot of things that went on in the past and even by close measurements, make some calculations on what happened. Anyway, where did the water go is the huge question. I mentioned trying to interpret the Martian surface in terms of what kind of history it might have had is really tricky. The big question is, where did the water come from? Where did the water go? And the atmospheric pressure today is far too low to support the kind of flows you see on the surface. It would suggest then that the atmosphere was much more extensive in the past. It has a weak gravity, I've already pointed out. It can't hold on to an atmosphere. So there must have been a time or times in the past when Mars had a much more extensive atmosphere. And with a much more extensive atmosphere, it had greater atmospheric pressure that could sustain more water, but also if the temperature were warmer, it could sustain liquid water for some period of time. So almost everybody agrees that sometime Mars had a much larger atmosphere and a much warmer environment than today. And as I said before, many researchers now, I'm not talking about recent creationists now, I'm talking about secular scientists, have suggested that at one time there was a global or nearly global flood on Mars. Sort of like on Earth, right? What I find amazing is that these scientists almost universally would reject the idea that the Earth once was engulfed in water, as the book of Genesis tells us it was. And we're living on a planet that's awash in water. We've got lots of water here. If you evened out the surface of the Earth and just allowed the water to assume the level, it would be 2 kilometers or more in depth. That's how much water we have. We have lots of water here on the Earth. Yet these scientists don't believe that there was a global flood on Mars. But yet, when you go to Mars, the planet that has no water today, they believe there was a global or near global flood. Isn't that amazing that people can believe something like that, all the while rejecting it as being reality here on this planet? Well, probably most of the water evaporated away, as did the atmosphere, but there is perhaps permafrost on Mars today. Permafrost, you find at high latitudes. Most places you have a lot of groundwater, and you have to go down deep in some places to find it, but almost anywhere on Earth, if you go down deep enough, you'll hit water. But permafrost, the temperature is never very warm, and so you have many times the soil and rocks are saturated with water to considerable depth, but it's so cold it stays frozen all the time. And only during a brief summer would there be a thaw that takes place. A top foot or so would thaw out. Northern Canada and places where nobody lives, for the most part, is like that. It's a pretty nasty place in the summer, as I understand, when the mosquitoes. You think you have mosquitoes bad elsewhere. They're really bad there, I understand. Here's a photograph of a crater on Mars, which they think is evidence of frozen water, permafrost. This is a crater called Ude on the surface of Mars, and you'll notice that surrounding that crater is what we call the ejecta blanket, kind of that irregular-looking, rounded terrain there. And I've seen that sort of feature before. If you go to the beach and watch waves come in, sometimes you can get a lot of sand and stuff suspended in the water, and it comes in and sloshes up, and then when it drains out, the water just suddenly drains into the sand underneath, and it leaves the sand, the sediment load there in place, and it leaves that kind of rippled, curved sort of appearance. I even quite inadvertently caused this sort of thing to happen in a sandbox in my backyard about 20 years ago. We had a lot of rain, and I was putting a bucket out on the edge of the sandbox to collect water, and I went out just to measure. It was about 4 inches, about to overflow the top of the bucket. So I measured how much water we had, and I just dumped the water back into the sandbox because we were expecting more rain. Well, without much rain, the sand was pretty saturated with water, and so when I dumped this water into the sandbox, it hit the sand and it excavated a crater. and the leftover water kind of splashed out with the sediment load that it just picked up. Went out a short distance, the water dropped down into the sand below, and it left behind that kind of rounded sort of pattern like this. So I ran inside and got a camera and took some pictures of it. The neat thing was, this photograph here is black and white. It is from the Martian surface, but the sand we had, being in the Piedmont of South Carolina, had a bunch of red clay in it, so it was red. And when I showed the picture to people, they thought it was actually from the surface of Mars. It was amazing. But it looked just like that. It was amazing. I guess I should scan that and start showing that on my presentations. But again, doing some experimentation, I've seen this pattern before. In this case, instead of dropping out and leaving behind the sediment load, what they think happened is it froze in place. Perhaps the permafrost is down in the soil and rocks. The impact comes in, it releases a tremendous amount of energy. It excavates the crater, but it also heats the rock and soil up so that the water now becomes liquid. It's a slurry. It starts to splash out. It goes so far out, it refreezes and drops the sediment load right there. So that's evidence of that. It's so much to the point that many people think that if you were going to take a mission to Mars and spend a year on the surface, instead of taking a lunch of water with you, you could take drilling equipment and excavate water and use it there. I would sure hate to go to Mars expecting to do that and find out you don't have any water. That would be terrible. You'd want to send a probe, first of all, and drill for the water and make sure there's enough water there to meet your needs. You'd be awful thirsty otherwise. So, anyway, attempts to find life on Mars, besides just looking for evidence like Lowell did. By the way, you may wonder about those canals. Those canals appear to have been optical illusions. The straight lines that he saw, the canals, bear no resemblance, no correspondence at all to the actual river channels. You can't see the river channels from the Earth's surface. So it was basically an optical illusion he was looking at. And it's most unfortunate, but that's reality. And of course, Barnard, the other keen observer, never saw them, as it stands vindicated all these years later. But the 76 Viking lander experiment had some pretty sophisticated experiments that, for the most part, seemed to indicate that life did not exist. And then back 17 years ago, there was this meteorite, you may recall, I heard about that in the news at the time, Allen Hills 84001. Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Anybody remember this? It was this thing, this Martian meteorite. It was this meteorite that was landed on Earth, and they think it was blasted off the Martian surface. And they found four evidences for life, they thought, that once existed there. That made a big news. Remember I talked about what a news story life on Mars is? Well, that made a big splash back in 96. And then there were hundreds of other papers critiquing in detail the findings of that initial report. Did you hear about that in the news? No, you didn't. And for years after that, even to today, there are people that come up to me and they argue with me, telling me that they found life on Mars. You know, well, no, they didn't. They found evidence that some people interpreted as evidence of life on Mars, but big difference there. Spirit Opportunity had some approaches to look for life on Mars with the cameras and so forth that they had. And there are some future missions being planned. It turns out, the idea that Mars may have supported life in the past never went away. That idea has waned and waxed. It's amazing. Every time you drive the heart through the stake through the heart of that idea, just like a vampire, just seems to keep coming back. It won't go away for some reason. Now, as a creationist, I would not expect life on Mars today or in the past. That's just, I can't prove that biblically, but so now we could talk about this for a while and I could reach that conclusion. But that's my expectation based on what I consider a biblical creation model. Well, why do so many scientists keep looking for life on Mars when study after study after study seems to slam the door shut every time? And that's interesting. We'll talk about this. The argument goes something like this. Did I skip a slide? No, I guess I didn't. All right. Why look for life on Mars? Well, if life evolved on Earth, then it probably evolved elsewhere. But why would you say that? Well, if life evolved on the Earth, but only on the Earth, nowhere else in the universe, what does that suggest about the Earth? it's special, it's unique, all right? And if the earth is special and unique, doesn't that kind of bring you back, right back to creation again, doesn't it? I mean, if life is just one of those things that happens wherever the conditions are right for it, then you would expect in this big, vast universe that it ought to happen, have happened on a number of planets, not just on the Earth. If we're the only place in existence where life exists, then that really, really smells of creation big time. And really, it's hard to escape that reality. And so in recent years, people have found, last 30 years or so, we found a lot of organisms living in hostile environments. These are called extremophiles. They find them living at very high altitudes, very deep down inside the earth, down inside of wells. They found organisms there. They found them under ice in Antarctica, under extensive ice sheets. They found them growing around hydrothermal vents and deep ocean vents. So these things are living on the edges, the margins of where you used to think life could exist. And so now the thinking has changed. You know, when I was growing up, the idea was it was some sort of primordial soup that life arose. You had a warm body of water with organics in it, and life just kind of popped in this very nice, warm, comfortable environment. But now the feeling is many scientists now think that life, instead of starting in some nice, warm, cozy environment, actually started in the hostile environments and then colonized to the nice, comfortable places. It'd be like humanity arising in the Arctic and then we fled down to the tropics to get out of the hostile environment. It's just kind of a backward way of looking at it. And I think what's really driving this is the hope that somehow they'll find that life exists on hostile planets and satellites and so forth in the universe. And even with that, most of these scientists don't believe that Mars has life today. They think, however, when in the past it was warmer and wetter than it was today, life somehow evolved there. And then it died out as the conditions got worse on Mars. So the best chance, they think, for finding life on Mars is to look for fossils that it might have existed on the surface at one time. And that's the direction this sort of thing is going today. Let's take a brief look at Venus. Venus is very similar in size, mass, and density to the Earth. I contrasted the Mars to the Earth, and Mars is quite a bit smaller, less mass, and gravity is quite a bit less. But as it turns out, Venus is very similar, within a few percent of all those characteristics. The surface gravity on Venus is very similar to the surface gravity on the Earth. And so some people have called Venus Earth's twin. And at one time, through the 1950s, people thought that life might exist on Venus. It's covered with clouds. You can't see the surface. When you think of clouds, you're thinking of water vapor. That's what clouds are, ice droplets. That's or ice crystals. That's what clouds on the Earth are made out of. So, again, I remember seeing stories and reading stories when I was growing up of a tropical environment on the surface of Venus. People thought it might have been a lush tropical vegetation sort of place with all sorts of creatures living there as well. Anybody here read C.S. Lewis's space trilogy? He had Owl of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength, one on Mars, one on Venus, and one on the Earth. Perelandra was the name for Venus. And it has a lot of symbolism, very easy to catch there. You've got an ocean planet, which is pretty popular thinking when he wrote this in the late 40s, I believe. And you had some floating islands on this, and you had two green people. I don't know why they were green. That's what the storyline was. A man and a woman, and they represented Adam and Eve. And then one day, a man from Earth showed up, and he represented Satan. And you see the symbolism going back to the garden in all of this. Very neat story. That was kind of the environment where C.S. Lewis wrote his book. As it turns out, the atmosphere is very different from the Earth's outer. We began to discover that in the late 50s, and it's only gotten worse ever since then. The pressure there, unlike Mars, it goes the other direction. It's 90 times the pressure on the Earth, Earth's atmospheric pressure. To find the equivalent pressure On Venus, you would have to go down nearly a kilometer below the surface of the oceans to reach that kind of pressure. So it's a crushing sort of pressure. They have an extreme greenhouse greenhouse effect going on there. It makes it very hot. The temperature there is hot enough to melt lead. So it's extremely hot. I once gave this talk in Arizona, and a talk like this in Arizona, and I gave the temperature. There's like 900 degrees Fahrenheit. And I said, but since there's no water, it's a dry heat. And you all chuckle about that, but it brought the house down in Arizona, because that's all they tell each other. You know, it's 117 outside, but it's a dry heat. You know, well, don't you believe it? I've been in 110 out there, and it's hot. I don't care how dry it is, it's hot. All right. So very little water, a little vapor, but there's no liquid water, no ice either on the surface. And interesting enough, we can penetrate those clouds with radar. We've done that with a couple of space probes. And we end up with continent-like features on Venus. These are things that rise up above the average level. And so there's some similarities to the surface of the Earth and Venus in that respect. And there's some evidence of some something like plate tectonics on Venus. You know, you've known probably if you've studied Earth science at all, about 50 years now, the ruling paradigm has been what we call plate tectonics, that the Earth's surface consists of these large plates. You have continental plates like the North American plate, and you've got the Atlantic plate and the Pacific plate, and some collisions going on. It explains mountain building and all this kind of stuff. Well, the idea is on Venus, you have something like plates. It's a little different, but still plate-like features on the surface of Venus. And some lines of evidence suggest something very interesting. What we find on Mars is, Venus, okay? What we find on Venus is that it has impact craters, like the Moon and Mars have, except they're fairly sparse. They're fairly sparse. And the way we've interpreted craters on surfaces such as Mars and Venus and the Moon is crater density tells you something about the age. The more dense the craters are, the more craters you pack into an area, the older the surface is, because it hasn't been disturbed recently. And the more sparsely marked the craters are, the more recent the surface is. And Venus craters are pretty sparse, which suggests that the surface is fairly young. Now, we can quibble about what we mean by young. You know, to me, young and what to most evolutionary scientists would mean are very different things, but we can at least get relative ages out of this. And not only are they sparse, but kind of uniform. That is, if you go any surface on Mars, the average crater density is about the same as it is anywhere else. So it tells everybody, I think everybody would agree on this prospect, that sometime in the recent past, the entire surface of Venus was reworked. That is, you had a surface sitting here, and through volcanic tectonic activity, the entire surface was recycled and resurfaced. We're not looking at the original Martian surface. We're looking at the Venusian surface. We're looking at a new surface of Venus that isn't that old at all. So the entire surface was overturned in a relatively brief period of time. That's interesting. The other line of evidence is that the craters on Venus show the same morphology. Older craters tend to be worn down through erosion processes, and more recent craters tend to be very sharp. And all the craters on the surface of Venus are very sharp, again, indicating age. So both lines of evidence here suggest recent surface activity and the entire surface completely reworked in the not-too-distant past. And so this suggests, again, as I mentioned, the entire reworking, the entire overturning of the surface of the planet in a short length of time. Now, again, these are not recent creationists saying this. These are secular scientists committed to a 4.5 billion year old history, concluding that the entire surface of Venus was turned over in a very catastrophic worldwide event. Sort of like, well, catastrophic plate tectonics, which is something that recent creationists have suggested happened on the Earth. Here's a composite radar image showing altitudes. It's been color-coded, much like a color-coded map on the Earth would look like. You know, the deep, low-lying areas are going to look kind of blue, and then the less deep would be more green, and higher elevations would be more brown and even white. That would be, of course, water and green and rock showing up in different places. That's on the Earth, of course. On Venus, we're not suggesting there's liquid water and vegetation and so forth. We're simply color-coding it. If this were Earth, Earth-like conditions, this is what might want to look like. So, again, blue is low elevation, and white would be the highest elevation. So it looks similar to some of the continental structures on the Earth. Here's another half of it showing up. There are some differences between the Earth and Venus, but there are some similarities as well. Here's one of the impact craters. This is a radar image. You'll notice the ejecta blanket out there on Beauty. It's kind of rounded. This is not quite as rounded, but it's white. And on the type of radar image we have here, that white indicates it's very jumbled. It's very rough terrain. On these types of maps where it's dark, it's smooth. And where it's light, it's very jumbled. And you expect an old crater would not have such a light-colored ejecta blanket, but a young one would. And they all look like this. They all have the same sort of morphology. So a comparison of these worlds, Venus is hostile to life with such high pressure and such high temperature. Living things could not survive very long on the surface of Venus. It's too hot and the atmosphere is too dense. And by the way, the composition is wrong. It really is, that explains all the problems on Venus. That's the planet that's closest to the Sun from the Earth. On the other side, a little farther out, Mars is hostile to life because it's too cold and the atmospheric pressure is too thin, and it also has the wrong atmospheric composition. And then there is the Earth. People would say it's the right distance from the Sun. Some people have called the Earth the Goldilocks planet. You know the story of Goldilocks, right? Well, one planet is too hot, and one planet's too cold, and one planet is just right, sort of thing. And that's interesting. People say they've derived what they call a habitable zone around a star like the Sun, and Venus and Mars are just kind of, you know, outside and inside that habitable zone. Where's the Earth? Well, it's right there where it needs to be. If you're too far or too close to the Sun, then the temperature's not right and you don't get liquid water, which we think is essential for life. And isn't just lucky that the Earth happens to be right there in that habitable zone? So maybe distance is the key to all of this. Well, it is a key, but it's not the key, because obviously distance is not enough, because the Moon is the same distance from the Sun that the Earth is, and it's dead as a doornail. And it's just lacking a lot of problems. One of them is atmosphere around it and water and all those kind of things. Kind of reminds me of the first restaurant on the Moon. Y'all hear about that one? The food's out of this world, but there's no atmosphere. So anyway, the Moon has one thing going for it. It's the right distance from the Sun. But it requires a lot more than that to have life going on. So there's a lot written about this. You may have heard of The Privileged Planet, the book and the video. It talks a lot about this. That's written from a believer, by the way. There's another called Rare Earth, written from a non-believer who reaches a similar sort of conclusion. He thinks the Earth is a rare place, but not because he believes in creation. It's interesting how you get two different people, same conclusion. What else about this? Well, Mars once had a large flood or floods on its surface, a global flood perhaps. And Venus once had catastrophic plate motion. You know, recent creationists have proposed that both of these took place at the time of the flood, recorded in Genesis. The global flood's pretty clearly taught in the book of Genesis, but then as far as catastrophic volcanic and plate motions taking place, that's kind of an inference people have drawn. That's not taught in Scripture clearly, but it's an inference people have drawn as a part of a model for all this. And so what people have proposed is that the Earth once had both of these take place on its surface, and yet secular scientists for the most part, deny that either one of those processes took place here on the Earth, but they readily think that one of them took place on Mars, and they readily think that the other one took place on Venus. And it's almost as if the Lord, you know, caused one to take place on Mars and one to take place on Venus, so that we at this late time, in a period of time when we actually can't explore these planets in detail, have the technology to do it, can see God's handiwork and see, look, I did it on one. In case you didn't get the message from my word, I left evidence on one planet that I did one of the two things that I did, and I left evidence on another planet that I did the other thing that I did on this planet, to show you that such things are possible on worlds. And so I believe that maybe that's the purpose, that Mars and Venus suit. They give us two things. They give us evidence, I think, indirectly so, an inference that such a thing is possible on the Earth. And also it shows us the uniqueness of the Earth and the fact that it alone seems to be suited and even designed for life. So both the Mars and Venus show how special the Earth is, and they reveal those processes that we think happened on the Earth at the time of the flood.